RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Connect, the place where you and I, as blind or partially sighted people, can talk about the big issues that affect us every single day. And that doesn't matter where you are in the world. Get in touch. It's your programme. Hello, I'm Stephen Scott, and this week is education. Who do I sound like there? We turn the spotlight on mainstream and specialist schools throughout the programme this week. Our roundtable guests have a wealth of experience and expertise to share, and a little later on we'll be hearing some of your school reports. Also in today's programme, Red Zell introduces us to the new lady in his life. Don't worry, Mrs. Zell, we're talking, of course, about his guide dog, Ella. Yeah, we'll hear all about how she's worked her magic on him in this week's Pause for Thought.
I have a suspicion of dogs. I'm very, very fond of her, and gradually she is making me far less suspicious of other dogs as well.
World Connect travels with Takashi Kikuchi from his early childhood in the Land of the Rising Sun to a life highlight playing at Glastonbury Festival.
I was particularly interested in things making some sound. Everything became my toys.
And Steve Vade, the acting CEO of Guide Dogs UK, reacts to last week's discussion on guide dog waiting times and criticism of the organisation not being open and transparent enough.
I thought that was really good, positive feedback, and I really appreciated it. We can do more to interact with our guide dog owners and explain what we're doing today, what we'll do in the future. And I've already started discussing that internally with my communications team.
That's all coming up this week.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
So thanks to everyone who's been in touch with us over the last week. It's always great to hear from our listeners. We were really delighted to hear from so many of you about this week's topic, education and the merits of mainstream and specialist settings. Now, for the most part, a formal school setting is something we all share, so everyone has an opinion on that. As pupils ourselves, as parents of visually impaired children, or even as professionals within the education system. Well, this week we invited Stacey Rowe, a mainstream pupil who graduated with a first class degree in maths, Victoria Oruwari, who was educated in Nigeria and the UK in both specialist and mainstream settings, and John Ram, a boarder at specialist school from the age of five and now father to four daughters, to join us at our round table. Guys, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
It's a great pleasure.
Good to be here.
So today on the Weekly Connect, we thought we'd talk about mainstream versus specialist education. It's an interesting time because a lot of parents are deciding at this point that, you know, the school that they may be putting their child into, and for blind children and partially sighted children, it's often a bit of a question mark. What's the best route? So I thought it'd be interesting to go around the table with a few of you and get your experiences and your thoughts on those. Stacey Rowe, we'll start with you. What's your experience? Is it mainstream or specialist for you?
So I was always educated in mainstream education. So I have no experience of special education. Primary school was always mainstream education. I don't think that was ever up for debate. But when it came to secondary school, it was a big deal in terms of where should I go. My family were very keen for me not to go to a special school. Having said that, my mother didn't want me to go to a mainstream school either, because I think she was quite worried about bullying and things like that, and particularly. But I was, you know, about 12 or something, and I was adamant that actually I wanted to go to the mainstream school because I wanted to be with my friends, my peers. And in the end, that's where I went. And it was fine, absolutely fine.
Yeah, I mean, a similar experience to me to some degree, because, you know, I started life off in mainstream school and mainstream primary, and then moved on to secondary school, and it was a fight. My mother had this fight in her saying, you will not go to specialist school. And, you know, I've never looked at it that way before, actually. You know, is it something that perhaps she was uncomfortable with rather than me ever being uncomfortable with? Never thought of it that way. Victoria, what's your experience?
Hi.
Well, I had a pretty interesting experience because I was a partially sighted kid in a mainstream school to start off with before I lost my sight completely. And then as soon as I lost my sight completely, I think what really saved me was that my sister had a friend in university who was blind. So she knew that being blind was not like the end of the world. So they took me to a special school far away from where I lived, and I had to board at the age of 7.5. And actually, I was excited because one thing I did observe when I did lose my sight was that my mum kind of didn't let me do anything, so I couldn't run around and jump around and fall. And I thought it was going to be so much fun to go to a school where I'd never been to boarding school before. And I was like, wow, a whole house full of children would just run riot. That's what I thought. So I was so happy. And in Nigeria, boarding school for blind people is very strict because Nigerians have this mindset that as a blind person, you will be exploited in the world. So toughening you up was better than mollycoddling you. So we did a lot of chores, and I learned how to sweep the floor and make my bed, and you know, you got the cane if you didn't do the right thing properly and stuff like that. And I think for me, coming from a background where I was really, really pampered at home, it was a huge shock to the system. But for my secondary education, there was no special school, so I had to go to mainstream, and that primary school's job was to prepare me for mainstream so that I wasn't a bit of a wimp when I got there. So I got there with the hatred of sighted people in mind, because that's what my primary school kind of prepared.
What's fascinating about your story, Victoria, is that it actually in a lot of ways seems a lot more forward thinking about people who have sight loss, rather than just mollycoddling, as is the case, I think, in the UK. I mean, I've not experienced specialist education, but I have seen a lot of and met a lot of children that who've become adults as a result of specialist education, and the mannerisms and the ways that people are. So you can often tell someone who's been through specialist education, which is always interesting.
Yes.
John, Ram, what's your experience been?
So I was born with a condition and was totally blind by the age of 10 months. And I'm a bit older than you guys, so I'm 52, which puts me into sort of school age at the end of the 60s. But I think in the UK at that point, there was very little thought about schooling in mainstream. So I went to specialist school from when I was five, ended up in St. Vincent's in Liverpool. And then when I got to secondary school age, they sent me to Worcester, which was the place to go, apparently, at the time.
I went and to Worcester.
Did you? Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, all the best people. No.
Yes, we did.
For me, it was just normal. It was completely normal to go to boarding school. People are sort of horrified about it now. You went from the age of five or whatever, but to me it was absolutely normal and a great experience, generally speaking, for me. So I did that right through till 18, A levels, and generally I found it okay. Now the thing is, then obviously stuff started to change because the prevailing wind said you had to educate in mainstream if possible. I've got four daughters, and one of them can't see. She's now 20. So she started off in mainstream school and did mainstream primary and junior. That was good. Mainstream secondary support was good, but possibly too good. She decided she wanted to go to Worcester for GCSEs. But actually, I think it was a bit of a shock to her system as well. I think it was a bit tough for her. So it sort of worked for her, but actually the other thing I think is that Worcester had changed a lot from when I was there. And it was interesting listening to Victoria talking about the sort of toughening up process, as she called it, which I think is a great thing and absolutely necessary in some ways. I mean, how you do it is a different matter, but it's absolutely essential that you're able to cope when you're out in the world.
Okay, let's leave it there for a moment because, you know, we could talk about this for hours, I'm sure. We will come back to John, Victoria and Stacey in a short while. This is The Weekly Connect. You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Thank you for joining us, as always. Another emotive topic was the discussion we had last week on The Weekly Connect. While wait times for guide dogs is what we started with, the conversation really travelled and we had a great range of opinions and experiences from you across the programme. So it was a real pleasure this week to sit down with Steve Vade, who is the Guide Dogs UK acting CEO, talking to us in his first radio interview since being appointed, where I put some of the issues you brought up to him directly. Steve Vade, thank you for giving me your time on the Weekly Connect this week.
No problem, Stephen.
So a number of our listeners, Steve, have been in touch about waiting times for a new dog, especially those who have already had a guide dog and are waiting for their next one. Can you tell us a bit about what Guide Dogs UK are doing to try and cut down those waiting times?
Yeah, I mean, I think every day a guide dog owner lives without their guide dog. It's difficult. You know, it affects their confidence. It has an impact on their family, on their ability to work independently, to move around independently. And it's an issue that we take extremely seriously. We work very closely with every single guide dog owner, understanding their needs. And our priority really is their safety, the suitability of a guide dog. And we do our very best to make sure that matching is as good as it possibly can be. Now, obviously, our guide dogs have to be born, they have to be trained, and that takes 7 to 8 months. And then the matching process between guide dog owner and the new guide dog can take anything between 2 to 4 weeks. And that's if there aren't any complications. So there is a built-in time lag as the dog's trained. But we aim to match every single client within 9 months is our target. And at the moment, 2/3 of our clients, our guide dog owners, are matched within that time. And 3 out of 4 of our guide dog owners are matched within a year.
Okay. One of the comments we got, probably most commonly, is that guide dogs seem to be doing a lot more these days. It's involved in a huge amount of work with, for example, Microsoft to try and develop new technology to help blind people get around using their guide dog as well. And I think a lot of people are quite happy to see that work go on, but not to the expense of training and making available guide dogs. Here's a comment from Diane Woodford on last week's programme.
I think my local guide dogs are under an awful lot of stress to keep up with the demand, and they can only they can only work with so many blind people at the same time. And yeah. But then guide dogs are doing more and more things other than just guide dogs, and yeah, have they taken on too much?
So the question, Steve, ultimately being asked by Diane there, is: are guide dogs doing too much? What do you say to that?
I think we always have to strive to be better than we are today. And we know that from our research, there's over 180,000 people with sight loss who rarely leave home alone. And we know that a guide dog is not suitable for all of them. So by developing our My Guide service, we've helped over 2,000 people partner up with a volunteer, go out into their community, go to work, go to visit their friends and families. Through our children's service, we've helped hundreds of parents and their children get the best out of their early years and education. So I think we have to challenge ourselves continually to help as many people as we possibly can in many different ways. And I think there was another caller on your programme last week, Jane, who made the point that society is changing and people with sight loss today have different needs, and they will use technology, for example, in a different way to people 20, 30 years ago, and we have to adapt to that as well. So the guide dog service absolutely remains at the heart of what we do. It's our heritage, our history, it's the area we invest the most in terms of our resources, and it's absolutely core to what we are as an organisation. But we know we can work in many different ways to help a broader cross-section of people with sight loss as well. The need is huge.
And it's interesting that you bring up that comment from Jane Manley on last week's programme. Jane also made this comment.
I think where I stand is that I'm looking at them as a solution to a lot of issues. The base that we have of people who are coming through with different types of sight loss need a different sort of response to the standard that we may have begun to appreciate in the old days. And I do accept that a lot of the advertising is centered on fluffy puppies that look cute and can, you know, just get people to extract coins from their pockets.
Yeah.
But
which needs to be done. We accept that that has to be done.
Absolutely. But where I think guide dogs fail is both to the wider community and to their members and users, is that they don't really have an open discussion about what's going on with the other things that they do provide. They're kind of the author of their own misfortune, because there isn't a huge amount of interaction, I feel, as a service user, between my views and expectations and understanding and what's actually happening within the organization. I suppose I stand very squarely in the middle. I feel that there are points that I wish guide dogs would change, and I'm hoping that the change of CEO will breed a new transparency and a new engagement, but that will enable me to understand the broader reach of guide dogs, so that I know that what I get from them is just a small part of what they are becoming for the future.
Comment there from Jane Manley on last week's The Weekly Connect. Steve Vage, you are now the acting CEO of Guide Dogs UK. Some see you as a new broom, a chance to change the organisation, take it in a different direction. What do you say there to Jane's points about Guide Dogs being more transparent, more open? What do you think about those comments?
I thought that was really good, positive feedback, and I really appreciated it. I think we can do more to interact with our guide dog owners and explain what we're doing today, what we'll do in the future. And I take that as really constructive feedback. And I've already started discussing that internally with my communications team.
And Steve, just going back to an earlier comment that was made, and we talked a little bit about guide dogs doing too much. I think a lot of our listeners might also be wondering the question about the kind of work that you're now being asked to do and expected to do, perhaps, as a result of the amount of council cuts these days. Is that having an impact on the services you're able to deliver?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're seeing more and more inquiries and demand for our service. I think the number of inquiries we received has gone up by about 60% in the last few years. And it is worrying because local authorities are under pressure, and the support that I guess used to be there around rehabilitation and basic orientation and mobility is not there for many people. And we do as much as we can in that area, but again, our resources are limited, and there doesn't appear to be any alternative to that at the moment in terms of social services and local authorities.
You know, it's interesting, Steve. I speak to a lot of different people through the course of this job, and, you know, I know a lot of blind people. I was a guide dog owner myself for a couple of years, a long while ago. It's always interesting to me that the kind of impact you have as an organisation can sometimes impact on the kind of feedback that you get. And interestingly, setting up this conversation and, you know, looking at last week's programme and the conversations we had with many people on air, a lot of them said, in addition to other people who had mentioned this, that, you know, they were almost nervous about coming forward and criticising guide dogs because they might end up being pushed to the back of the queue when it came to a point where, you know, they were applying for their next guide dog. Now, I'm pretty sure no one in guide dogs has ever suggested such a thing, but does it highlight to you the impact of the work that you do equals the impact of the guide dog and the service and all of that, to the extent that people might not come forward and give you feedback and constructive criticism of your organisation?
I would really encourage them to, because that's the only way we can improve, by listening and having that two-way dialogue. But our staff are incredibly professional and amazingly experienced, and our clients, our guide dog owners, are truly at the heart of what we do. And yes, the guide dog is transformative for many people and has amazing impact from day one, and if we don't have that two-way dialogue, we can't fully assess the impact or some of the challenges that a guide dog owner may have. So I'd really encourage anyone who's feeling anxious or worried to talk to their local guide dog team and explain that. Our staff truly, truly dedicated, Stephen, and that they will listen and they will take all that feedback into consideration. We make a lifetime commitment, as you know, to our guide dog owners. And there are many, many people who have been with us on their fifth, sixth guide dog over 30, 40 years. And I really think we do our very best not to let them down. We do our very best to help them improve and transform their lives.
Steve Vade, Acting CEO of Guide Dogs UK, thank you for giving us your time.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Take care.
He's a busy man and we appreciate his time. That was Steve Vade there, who is the acting CEO of Guide Dogs UK, following the departure just recently of Richard Lehman. We thank him for his time, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview on our podcast if you've not already downloaded it. Why not? You can download The Weekly Connect and The Weekly Connect Features podcasts. Those are available to you on iTunes, Audioboom. They're also available via your Victor Reader Stream and the Sonata Wireless Audio Player, so do check those out there. And if you have any issues getting those podcasts, then do get in touch with us. You can always email us, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. That's where we encourage you to send in your thoughts on the programme. And you can also send us a message through Twitter as well. If you're on Twitter, we are at RNIB Radio, and you use the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. This is your space to raise the issues that affect you. Tell us your thoughts on what Steve said or anything else you've heard on the programme. Or you might have an issue that you think it's time for us to raise. Get in touch, email or tweet. This is The Weekly Connect.
RNIB wish to say a warm thank you to Waitrose, as this Christmas, RNIB will be one of four charities who benefit from a 10% share of the sale price of Waitrose Charity Christmas Cards. Waitrose Charity Christmas Cards come in a range of designs and packs, and they are on sale now from Waitrose stores and the Waitrose online Christmas shop. RNIB is really grateful to Waitrose for helping us to raise funds and make every day better for those living with sight loss around the UK.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Now, when we announced we were talking about mainstream versus specialist education on this week's programme, well, we couldn't stop you from getting in touch. It was great. Thank you for everyone who got in touch. Robin Dunford sent us his thoughts.
My name is Robin, and I live in Hereford in the West Midlands. I have partial vision, but my eye condition is cataracts, corneal ulcers, and collarbone of the iris. My schooling days started in a village 3 miles from Dorchester. The village school was very tiny, so I'm talking about now 1962. Teaching levels were then for vision impaired people. The school was very limited, really. I mean, I had to go walking backwards and forwards to see what they'd written on the blackboard. So it was quite difficult, really, especially for somebody my age. And then when I was 11 years old, it was decided, because of my visual impairment, then it might be better for me to go to a specialised school. So then I went on to the West England School at Exeter for partially sighted pupils. Quite strange, really, because there were no actually blind pupils there, just partially sighted pupils like myself. So we didn't get the opportunity to learn Braille, which would have been a useful thing to have done at the time. There wasn't a huge amount of difference between going there and the junior schools. Again, a blackboard was used in lessons, but they did have the addition of overhead projectors, and we used typewriters, and there was a library of large print books, which was quite good at the time. And there I stayed until I left school, which was 1969.
Must say, it might sound a bit weird to our younger listeners, but I bet some of you remember the walk to and from the blackboard to read what was on it, those of us who could actually read it. I could do that in those days, at least. Can't do it anymore. And thank goodness there's no such thing as blackboards anymore. I think they're all whiteboards now, aren't they? Well, thanks, Robin, for sharing. We love to hear your stories. If you want to get in touch, please do. This is The Weekly Connect, the show where blind and partially sighted people share our views on the world. And the address to get in contact with us on email is theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. You can get in touch that way with an email, or you can tweet us. If you're on Twitter, we're at RNIB Radio, and we use the hashtag Weekly Connect. Now, let's go back to our conversation. Stacey Rowe, John Ram and Victoria Oruwari are still here with us. And thank you for staying with us through the programme, because, you know, one of the key things we wanted to talk about this week was mainstream versus specialist education, and all three of you have had different experiences of that, it's fair to say. But it's an interesting time because parents are making their decision, usually around about now, as to where their child will go, and I guess parents, sighted parents, will be wondering what to do now with their child. Do they put their child into specialist education, or do they get mainstream schooling with a bit of VI support? What's the best option? And I wanted to put this question to all three of you. And Stacey Rowe, I'll start with you on this one. Based on the experience you've already had, do you think that you would want to experience that again, or would you rather have had specialist education?
So for me personally, I'm glad that I got the experience that I did. I made some fantastic friends. I had a wonderful time overall. And, you know, I accomplished what I needed to, which was, you know, to complete the subjects in order to go to university. So I had a fear, and I guess part of me still does, but I wonder if it's moved on. That thing you said about you can tell someone who went to a specialist school sometimes, you can, for me, I think I would worry that that would have happened. So I think, and people can correct me, that I don't stand out in any way.
But can I ask you a question? When you say the mannerisms were different, did you think Steve meant it in a negative way or a positive way?
Well, I mean, I think obviously we have to be careful, because it's very individual, and there are a lot of people who went to special school who, you know, are just like you and me, and everyone's different. Yes. I think society sees anyone, any difference, as something to be feared, and I think that is a shame. So, you know, if there's a mannerism that perhaps is not common, then I think that could have an effect on whether or not, you know, you get the job that you've interviewed for. Or, and it shouldn't, really. It shouldn't make any difference. But I think society are still quite judgmental.
Yeah, I think we've got to be fair here. You know, I think you've been very diplomatic, Stacey.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think, you know, what you're saying is that, you know, it is an individual thing. But let's be honest about it. You know, if you end up, as a result of being at specialist school, that you end up having a rocking as part of your, you know, makeup, that you rock back and forward all the time and those kind of things. A lot of blind people do. You know, and you know, we've maybe all had a bit of it in our lives. I have a weird thing with my head. That sounds wrong, but, you know, a weird thing with my head where, you know, I sort of float from side to side because of the nystagmus I've got, and I'm always trying to check myself for it. But what I'm aware of is that people who come from, and it's not everyone, of course it's not everyone, but there are some people who come from specialist education, it seems, who are never able to check themselves as a result of that.
Yeah, but can I say something? When I was in the Nigerian specialist school, any mannerism that was considered weird was knocked out of you. And I feel that there were some approaches that Nigerians took that was really out aimed to prepare you so that when you went out there, you were fighting with, you know, you were fighting on an equal playing field. And what I observed when I actually went to New College, you know, Worcester, it was a wonderful place with all the facilities and everything in place. But I just think that there was perhaps a bit too much help and too much on the emotional side, very much mollycoddling. You know, the staff were really nice. And in fact, I almost saw them as parents. And I thought, wow, like, I didn't know human beings could be created to be so wonderful. It made me feel so safe and so complacent about everything. If I'd been there for more than 2 years, I'd hate the world.
That's my point, though. That is partly my concern as well for those people who come out of specialist education.
Yeah,
if it's such a mollycoddling, that actually is it a case that, you know, they fear the world. And when something doesn't go their way,
they can't cope with it.
They can't cope.
Yeah.
I think there's I did visit one of the blind schools. A couple of things struck me. One of them, going back to what we were saying earlier about behaviours, there were a couple of people eating mashed potato with their hands.
What?
They weren't being corrected.
New College wouldn't have tolerated that. That's one thing I was sure of.
Yeah, they weren't being corrected.
Yeah.
Okay. So that really scared me. I didn't want to be that person.
No, that's basically absolutely right. I think and the thing is, for me, there's a couple of things there. It's a combination of the education and the family background as well.
Exactly.
So lots of parents, I think, are very overprotective. You know, my mum had a fantastic policy. She said, if I can't see what he's doing, I'm not going to worry about it, which was great because I got up to all sorts of things. But the other thing they constantly did, given, I say, bear in mind that I'm totally blind, they constantly said, look at the person you're talking to, you know, use your knife and fork, you know, don't do silly things. I wasn't quite into Victoria's phrase about having it knocked out of me, but it was certainly educated out of me.
Well, I didn't mean physically, but they do talk you. Yeah.
But the other thing you've got to bear in mind, I think, is that in a lot of specialist schools now, because of the environment where people are encouraged to educate in mainstream, the specialist schools have become, I think, a bit desperate, and they've taken people with all kinds of disabilities. Now, when I said desperate, I didn't mean that in a bad way. I meant they struggle to populate their school.
Yeah,
they struggle to populate their school with people who just have visual impairments. So they end up having a number of difficulties, you know, maybe autism or other things, which might tilt people towards some of these mannerisms. And there were some pretty weird people at Worcester, in fairness, but there are probably weird people in most schools.
Yeah,
they are. But you see, in my defense of Worcester as well, because even though I say that there was all this mollycoddling, I'd had the toughening up from Nigeria. But one thing I also did learn in Worcester that I don't think I could have picked up on in mainstream were my rights as an individual, as the blind person, being able to ask for what I need and being able to know what I need and understand the difference between my rights and my responsibilities. I think they were very good at teaching that and making you feel assertive and, you know, that you count as well. Because when I went to mainstream in Nigeria, my experience was totally different. I mean, I did not experience bullying from the teachers. That's one thing I will say. They were excellent. And the things they didn't know, they asked you. But they also, again, did not mollycoddle you because they felt you got into the school by merit and you had to be, you know, you had to get an education out of it. But the children, oh my goodness, I met a variety of human beings. Some were extremely nice. Some took the mick out of me. And yes, I was integrated, but it didn't mean that all the kids I went to school with ended up my friends. I'm only in touch with two people. So you can see that, yes, the school did try to integrate, but it didn't work in the society.
That's fascinating. I think thinking about parents choosing schools for children, for me, it's the important thing is that they look at all the options. And we know that some local authorities don't even tell you what options are around.
Oh, yeah.
So, definitely. You know, if you have a VI child, you need to force, if you like, ensure that your local authority gives you all the information that's available.
Yeah.
And you need to trawl the internet and have a look around and, you know, make sure that you know, because they are obliged to give you the information about what's available, even if it is out of the county, but they don't always do it.
Stacey, any final thoughts?
Yeah, it's very interesting actually on the point about mollycoddling, to go back to that, because the biggest problem I had at mainstream school was that I was far too mollycoddled.
Yes.
By
it also happens. Yep.
It really did. And it was a big issue for me, because I remember when I first, you know, the first day, the support staff that were there said, right, you have to come and eat your lunch with us.
Yep.
And I said, what? Yes. No, I'm going to eat with
your friends.
And
yeah.
It was a battle every day. And I would run away. They would take me to lunch. They would turn their backs and I'd run. And I'd go with my friends. And time again, it didn't stop, actually, until I was about 16 or 17. And every day, every single subject, you had a support teacher in the classroom with you. And it was difficult to interact with your peers because you always had essentially a teacher by your side.
By your side.
You could never just relax. You could never be a kid, really, in that environment. And I think I think that's something that, that parents should consider when they're, you know, mainstream versus specialist school. Get involved in not just the education, but the overall experience that their kids would have in the school. Look at the whole picture.
I think it's really important that parent, because I think what really makes such forms a blind child's life if there is their parents' approach to their disability. And I feel that when every child is diagnosed with a disability, that parents should actually get a lot of counselling from well-informed people. And I can't stress that more, because I think so, sometimes actually the parents are the last to accept what's happened. I don't know, from my point of view, it would be cruel to throw a blind child in a mainstream school at the age of 5, 6, because that child is learning to be a blind person, and putting them in an environment where they're already vulnerable, the child is not going to be getting a clear view of what life is really meant to be like, because they don't know what they need. They're still trying to figure that out. I think childhood is tough enough as it is. And yeah. I think it's better if the child is educated about their disability and how well to deal with it, then join the mainstream system in secondary school, I think.
Sorry, I was going to just second quickly what Stacey was saying. One of the key factors for my daughter deciding to go to Worcester was to get away from the support. Now, the support was really, really well-meaning. They really wanted to help her. But she was admitting that, you know, there were times when she let the support worker do her work for her. Because, you know, when you're 14 and someone offers to do that, why would you not?
Yeah, exactly.
Why would you not? Exactly.
But she knew it was bad for her as well. And so that was one of the factors in her leaving mainstream.
Well, we've probably left people with more questions than answers. I think that's fair to say. You know, I think ultimately it is about a conversation like this, and it's about people having conversations with other people who are blind and partially sighted who've been through it themselves. I think that often helps. So, you know, lots of food for thought. I will say, just on that point, Stacey, around eating separately at school time, lunch times, I have to tell you very briefly that I had a wonderful experience where in my first week at secondary school, I was introduced to the visually impaired table at my school, where we all had to sit and eat together.
Table that couldn't sit.
And it was a table.
We had that in Nigeria, yeah. In the secondary school, the visually, the blind table, that's what it was called.
Yeah. And it was a table right at the top of the dining hall. So all the other kids were staring at you, sitting at their tables, thinking, why have they got their own table, that big table at the end? And of course, it was right next to the teachers, so they could look after us. Yeah. Mainstream versus specialist, the debate goes on. Guys, I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, what were your experiences of schooling? Were you given the tough love the Victoria experienced, or were you made to eat with the teachers too? Do let us know. Yeah, they did that. I know, it's incredible, isn't it? Tweet us at RNIB Radio using hashtag The Weekly Connect. Time to meet Ella, I think, and her human. That's the way you might look at it. The one and only Red Cell. Journalist, author, climber, and soon-to-be host of our very own Read On programme on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi, my name's Red Sale, and I'm here this afternoon with my new guide dog, Ella, who's half black lab, half golden retriever. I'm not a natural dog lover. I got bitten on the face by an Alsatian when I was 3, and even 44 years later, I have always been rather suspicious of dogs, almost as suspicious as my cat. But after falling into the model boat pond on Hampstead Heath, just missed the edge with my white stick, I decided that it was probably quite a good idea to get some additional help. So I applied for a guide dog and got sorted out remarkably quickly. I think it was within 7 months. She came and joined our family, and despite my initial reservations, she's become very much part of the family and my visual aid. I've been finding it more and more difficult to navigate the streets of northwest London because so many cafes now have become pavement cafes, and every second shop seems to have an A-frame advertising what they sell in front of them. So it's become a little bit like a sort of glorified game of Donkey Kong navigating the streets of London. And I was coming home battered and bruised and frustrated and actually getting quite agoraphobic, to be honest. There's not always someone who's shoulder you can grab to take you back and forth to the supermarket or
to meet somebody for a cup of coffee. And the fact that she can lead me around all the obstacles and get me there in one piece just is a huge weight off my mind. It means I actually look forward to going out now rather than dreading it. She is, like I think an awful lot of guide dogs, a tummy on legs. And recently we were walking down the pavement and there was a toddler eating a croissant or something in front of us. And I could just tell through the harness that she'd latched onto something, she was totally and utterly focused on something ahead of us that wasn't necessarily the pavement. The kid must have dropped the croissant, and suddenly we leapt forward and she hoovered up whatever it was off the pavement. And all I could hear was this child going, "That dog's eaten my bread." So I had a bit of explaining to do, and she hasn't done it since. It's quite unfortunate. On the way to the heath to go swimming every day, I do walk past a very nice pub. And when I completed my training, I went for a celebratory pint. And the waitress in the pub came up and said, "Oh, what are you celebrating? Oh, what a beautiful dog. Isn't she wonderful? And, well, if you're having a pint, then presumably she'd like some dog treats." And she went and found some dog treats. And now every time we walk past the pub, Ella makes a beeline for the door. And I think everybody thinks that I've trained her to locate my local pub. I think that having Ella in my life has actually made me as mobile as I was about 4 or 5 years ago before my retinitis really took hold and started destroying what little sight I had left. So I can actually enjoy going out again. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And I think I'm overcoming my suspicion of dogs. I certainly find her... I have a suspicion of dogs. I'm very, very fond of her. And gradually she is making me far less suspicious of other dogs as well. And she's, as I said, become very much part of the family and very much a companion to me, which when I'm sitting at home and trying to write the books that I write, it's lovely to have some company there.
Thanks to Red there and Ella, of course, let's not forget. If you have a guide dog story you have to tell us about, then please do get in touch. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk is our email address. Now, stick around. We have got our Society of the Week coming up this week. It's one that does great work with blind children. And World Connect travels with Takashi Kikuchi from his early childhood in the Land of the Rising Sun to a life highlight. Yes, playing at Glastonbury Festival.
I was particularly interested in things making some sound. Everything became my toys.
That's all coming up on The Weekly Connect.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for joining us. This is The Weekly Connect. Now, we've been hearing this week on the show about your experiences of schooling. Lots of you getting in touch about this. From Robin and John in the 60s to more recently, it seems clear to me that we've come a long way. And I guess school can be a difficult time for any child, whatever their ability. Whether it's a leg up or the extra push to get us across the line, we gain our confidence, we build independence and become more secure in ourselves when we get the right help. Help, yes, but the right help is important. And one society that exists specifically to support children and young people is VICTA. Now, Matthew, who's currently at university, has made friends and travelled widely thanks to VICTA. Let's hear more now about our Society of the week.
Hello, I'm Matthew. I'm 23 years old and I'm in my final year of history and business management at the University of Glasgow. I came to know Victor very well, properly for the first time in 2012, when they stepped in to help fund and continue the UK's attendance of the International Camp for Computing and Communications. The lady who'd previously helped the UK group to attend could no longer get the funding together, and Victor stepped in to provide the support and organisation that we needed to keep sending groups to it. On this camp, I've been to Vienna, Athens, and in 2012, Cluj in Romania. And just to me, an international camp like that is the summit of the incredible activities and experiences for children, young people, and families as well, with the younger kids as well, that Victor helps people to enjoy and to experience.
My name's Felicity and I work for Victor, and Victor stands for Visually Impaired Children Taking Action. We work with blind and partially sighted children from birth till 29. Victor was founded in 1987 by a group of parents in Milton Keynes to lobby the schools in the area for better support, and it's grown from there really. Every year we run two family weekends. There's one in May and one in August. During these weekends, the children get involved in a range of outdoor activities, so rock climbing, abseiling, raft building, quad biking, all things like that. For the parents, we run a variety of workshops and seminars with helpful information about personal independent payments, EHC plans, things like that, and it's an opportunity for parents to meet one another, support one another, and build their own networks of support. And it's a great chance for children to meet other people like them with similar conditions. And it's also a chance for their sighted siblings to meet other people with a visually impaired brother or sister, just to know that they're not alone.
I know how much these sorts of experiences, getting to meet people, getting to row through parks in the middle of Romania's second city, or getting to climb Snowdonia and go to Zipworld in North Wales with Victor. These sorts of things, they're not just fun. It's not just an opportunity to make friends. But I know that all the experiences I've had have helped make me happy and confident and interesting. And it's these sorts of things that Victor, for me, helps to make happen.
So we always have really positive feedback from people who come to our events. For example, we had an early years weekend in October, and one of the comments from a mother after she left was that she just felt like it was all going to be okay. And for us, that's what one of our aims is, that people feel supported and that they know that their child can achieve whatever they want, no matter what their sight is like. So that was a great thing for us. There was a Surrey Sight event, and the lady from Surrey Sight made a comment that she could tell which children had been on our activities because their confidence had grown and they just seemed so much happier and more comfortable in themselves.
Even though I have so many fully sighted friends at university, it is just so much easier to relax and not feel pressure when I am with my partially sighted friends. The trouble I have now is, having made all of these great friends who are all across the UK, it's a heck of a long way to go and visit some people, keeping in touch with all these great friends as we continue to do exciting things in life.
I love the amount of time I get to spend with people, all of the people that I get to meet and from different walks of life, and just seeing what visually impaired people are able to achieve, and just giving them an opportunity to reach those goals and to grow in their potential, and just give them a chance to meet other people and know that they're not alone. That's, I think, what I love most about the job.
Do you have a society that you want to thank? Is there a place like Victor that's helped you and you feel it could help others? Nominate your Society of the Week by dropping us an email to theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk or tweet us at RNIB Radio using the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. Now, the best thing about school, if you think about it, was school holidays. So let's fly off to Japan, shall we? Well, hang on. Just on the radio, at least in that sense, to meet Takashi Kikuchi. Now, when he went to specialist school in Japan, his parents' main concern wasn't to educate him for a career, but the discovery of music started him on a journey that gave him a vocation and brought him halfway around the world. Now, as an active member of the British Para Orchestra and freelance classical viola player, let's meet Takashi Kikuchi.
That means, hello, my name is Takashi Kikuchi. I'm from Tokyo. Tokyo is a very, very crowded city. Many thousands of people are in one small place. A lot of traffic, very busy road, even on the pavement. And fortunately, the people are kind, but otherwise it is very difficult for the people with any form of disability to negotiate with. In Japan, like many people say, we had a tradition to be negative about the disability. They rather use the word handicap, and that word was quite common. I was not familiar with the word disability until I actually came here. And I think this also explains the attitude. And the disabled people themselves also tended to be quite negative about their own conditions. But now the things are changing and the culture exchanging is happening more often and more widely. We are developing more open attitude. So it is now different from it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. When I was born almost 50 years ago, my family, first of all, didn't know what to do. And only the advice they first of all received was that my problem with the optic nerves wouldn't be cured. So I was sent to the National Blind School. And at the same time, I also had some occasions to visit the state school where the normal people usually go. So I had time to match up with some other pupils around the same age. And I got the confidence because I made sure that I was studying the same thing in the same level. I was, first of all, given the opportunity to experience some music when I was very small. And I first of all learned the piano and then violin. And my parents hoped I would have something I could enjoy in my life because there's no hope for curing my disability. And they thought I could have something to enjoy for all my life. So there's nothing to do with the ambition to become a professional musician or anything like that. I was particularly interested in the things making some sound. So some music instruments and other things like typewriters or even the old LP record players, everything became my toys. And I really enjoyed playing around with the machine. And sometimes it annoyed some people because once I touch it, I wanted to play with them. I enjoyed music making a lot. And gradually I became interested in studying it more properly. And gradually I became musical. I studied little by little. I didn't like practicing, but I liked playing with the instruments, which also annoyed the teacher, because in some ways I really liked the improvisation, and I didn't like to play anything I was told to. When I was about 16, I met the viola and I liked the sound very much, and I liked that depth and a sort of mellow colour of the sound, and I was really charmed by that tonality of the instrument, and I thought, this is the one instrument I could study professionally. I had a position in the National Top University for the performance arts, and I was already doing my doctoral studies there, and as a part of it I came to the Royal Academy of Music. So that was my first motivation to come to England. I have been in England for about 17 years now. The people ask me whether it was difficult to come here permanently, but for me it was difficult not to think about staying here permanently at some point, because everything was much more interesting than I thought. I really insisted I would do this, and I was very glad I was successful. With the British Bar Orchestra, we played in a closing ceremony at the London Paralympics. That was the first big event. I had an opportunity to play in Glastonbury with the same group. Well, there's a project called the Army of Generals, directed by Charles Hazlewood, and some members of the British Bar Orchestra are now sent to join them. So I was in Glastonbury at the end of June this year, and it was so exciting. Some people told me that we at least had 6,000-7,000 people listening there, and more than 200,000 people were watching and listening to us at home through the TV. And it was such an exciting moment. Very, very challenging for me to learn huge symphony. I was so glad I shared such an exciting moment with the colleagues, as well as many, many thousands of people watching and listening to us.
Great to hear Takashi there. That's it for the Weekly Connect for this week. Thank you again for listening. If you have a view on anything you've heard in the programme, do get in touch. We're here on email, theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk, or via Twitter @RNIBRadio. Use the hashtag TheWeeklyConnect. On next week's programme, we'll be talking about the world of gainful employment. Did you know that only 25% of visually impaired people are in work? Compare that to disabled people in general, who number 50% with a job, or 80% of the general population. Well, the government apparently want to hear our views for their green paper. So get in touch if you'd like to join our panel or have your views heard on the issue. Until next time, though, as always, thanks for listening. And remember, it's your show. Join the conversation on the next Weekly Connect.